And now Rick Atkinson and his critically acclaimed history of World War II. His new book is The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe, 1944-1945. Rick will be speaking tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For tickets, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. He's a former writer and senior editor at The Washington Post. He won a Pulitzer at the Kansas City Times for his stories in the West Point class of 1966. And Rick, good to have you here again. Congratulations on getting the last book of the trilogy out the door.
Thanks, Steve. It's always good to be back in my old hometown.
I was going to say, how big of a relief is it to get the last book done?
When Shelby Foote finished his trilogy on the Civil War, he said he felt like he'd swallowed a cannonball. I know what he's talking about.
What's that feel like, Rick? A whole cannonball?
You don't want to know.
Stainless steel?
In my case, it's probably a 105-millimeter artillery shell, something a little smaller.
I read in one of your interviews that you had moments early on as you began to scale this cliff, which is all this research on World War II and all of these books that you had a look at to sort of do what you wanted to do, where you wondered what on earth you had gotten yourself into here.
It's true. I did wake up on occasion with the night sweats wondering what I'd done. I had to teach myself historiography, among other things.
Which means what?
Well, the study of history. I had not grown as an academic historian, and I came up in the newspaper business, and consequently, archival research, for example, was something that I had not done much of, and that's the basis for this trilogy. And I wasn't entirely sure whether I would like it. Well, in fact, I found that I'm a real archive rat. I like it a lot. And it's fortunate because the U.S. Army records alone for World War II weigh...
Let me just say this. The U.S. Army records alone for World War II weigh 17,000 tons,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a lot of paper. And
is it? Really?
You can imagine. Let your imagination run wild. But it's both a curse and an opportunity because no one has ever more than scratched the surface of that great mound of paper that mostly is at the National Archives in Washington. So there were moments when I had my doubts, but I grew to feel pretty comfortable with the task. And certainly 14 years I've been living with these guys for, day in, day out, for far longer than the war itself was fought. And I'm very fond of them. They're basically my homeboys.
Hey, how do you begin to wrap your arms around 17,000 tons for just one branch of the military alone?
Well, I think actually having grown up as a newspaper reporter, I learned some skills there about making choices and there's a kind of triage that you apply to information gathering of any sort and organizing it and making sure that you're not chasing things down too many rat holes. And knowing when to cut bait, when I put a mark on the wall, basically, and I say, beyond this point, I will no longer research. I'm going to start writing here, and if I don't know it by then, I'll never know it. And
that's what you have to do.
You have to do it, or you wander into the woods and you never wander out.
Now, you came across something in your research that I wanted to ask you about, Rick, and that's this narrative written by the Georgia mortician who prepared FDR's body for burial after he died in Warm Springs back in 1945. What did that mortician write about FDR that day? It's very moving.
It's as powerful emotionally as it is clinical. I found it at the Franklin Roosevelt Presidential Library in Hyde Park, and he was summoned by the little White House in Warm Springs, Georgia, on April 12th, 1945. Roosevelt died in the middle of the afternoon from a cerebral hemorrhage. He was in Atlanta. He showed up some hours later. He had to wait outside the cottage where Roosevelt's body was because Eleanor Roosevelt had also been summoned, and he had to wait till she finished saying goodbye. He recorded in this 5 or 6 page account that she emerged dry-eyed. And then he went in and found...
Really?
Which
says a lot about a lot of things.
It says a lot about Eleanor and the relationship and so on. So he went in and he found the president's body. He'd been there long enough so that rigor mortis had set in. He describes using 6 bottles of embalming fluid and injecting it into the president's veins and arteries and otherwise preparing the president for eternity and how difficult it was, both emotionally and physically. the last thing that he does in this very arduous process that takes several hours is he summons the president's valet. His name is Arthur Prettyman, hands him a comb and asks him to comb the president's hair just so. So it's a really extraordinary moment. I describe Roosevelt as the greatest soldier of the war, even though he'd never heard a shot fired in anger.
Why did you think that readers would still be interested in World War II after all these years and all these books?
Because they are. Am quite certain of the fact that this just resonates very deeply in our history. It resonates in our families. There were 16.1 million Americans in uniform in a country of 130 million in 1944. Everyone had someone they loved in harm's way. Everyone had skin in the game. And now everyone has a father, a grandfather, a great-grandfather who had a connection somehow, fought in the war, was involved in the military. And we care about that. And, you know, the other part of it is so deeply imprinted in our political system and in our culture. The war affected the way we look at gender. It affects deeply the way we look at race. It affects the way we look at the world. And all of that, I think, continues to resonate 70 years later.
Rick Atkinson is our guest. His latest book, The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe. You're welcome to join our conversation this morning, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also send us an email to updatedate@kcur.org, or you can tweet us at @kcurupdate. You know, one of the tidbits of history, Rick, that always catches me up when it comes to the world wars is this idea that World War I and World War II are separated by just 20 years or so. And as you complete this series and you reflect on the carnage on such a massive scale from World War II, how convinced are you that we'll never see another World War again?
I'm reasonably convinced we'll never see a war like that one. Mechanized war, army groups thrown against each other. I'm not convinced that we will not see something horrible. It'll probably just take a different form if it happens. Hopefully it won't. It's been 70 years that we've managed to more or less keep the peace, at least on a global scale. But the scale of World War II, 60 million dead. That's one dead every 3 seconds.
Every 3 seconds,
For 6 years. And so, you know, hopefully we will never see anything quite as horrible as that again.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some calls. Michael from Lawrence, good morning.
Excuse me, can you hear me?
Yes, Michael, go ahead.
Okay, my last name is Perlman. I aspire to be... I'm hearing you.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit of feedback from something there, Michael. Why don't you call back in just a moment here at 816-235-2888. You know, I want to spin ahead to the end of the war, Rick, and your description of what American soldiers came across as they moved into Germany. You know, in terms of these revelations and this realization of the scale of German atrocities, how surprised were Allied forces at what they found, and how did they react to it all?
Most of them were quite shocked. Now, there had been camps liberated much earlier. Majdanek, the big death camp in Poland, had been liberated by the Soviets the previous summer 44, and there were reporters with them. And Time magazine, for example, had a very detailed account of the horrors of Majdanek. American soldiers had liberated a camp at Natzweiler near Strasbourg in the fall of 1944. But it was when they got to Bergen-Belsen, liberated by the Brits, and then the big camps liberated by the Americans, camps like Buchenwald and Dachau. And not only were the soldiers stunned, shocked, and in some cases so outraged that they committed murder, as happened at Dachau, but the world was shocked because even despite those earlier liberations, the world had not paid much attention to it, partly because World War I propaganda had inured people to thinking that this is exaggerated, that these awful things aren't happening. They're being exaggerated by the government. And but it's when they saw film reels, for example, from Bergen-Belsen, where you saw piles of bodies and emaciated inmates and all the horrors that we're now that we now associate with the concentration camps, that both the armies, the liberating armies, and their peoples at home recognize exactly what had been going on.
To what extent did the Americans, did the Allies sort of parade the Germans in front of this kind of horror, the German leaders, and have them recognize what they had done?
It happened on several occasions where the locals were rounded up and forced to walk past piles of bodies and in some cases dig mass graves.
The local Germans you're talking about.
Yes, the local Germans, both the citizenry and local officials. And James Gavin, one of the most celebrated combat soldiers commanding the 82nd Airborne at the time, he and his men liberated one camp, and he rounded up the local Germans from the town nearby and basically made them stand amid the horrors that had occurred in their backyard, essentially, and shamed them. It was a public shaming. And the Germans...
He shamed them how?
Well, he told them you could not do anything that would be more shameful than to be a German today. He says this to them, and it's translated into German. In many cases, they were forced, using their bare hands, to take these decomposing bodies and to rebury them, to put them in mass graves. In a couple of cases, there were mass graves dug on essentially the town square in these very gemütlich little pretty German villages. And, of course, all the time evidence is being gathered for legal reasons because there are going to be trials, as there were.
Now, given the fact that some of these camps were liberated the preceding year, any sense that the Allies should have rushed faster to sort of clear those camps and get to those people sooner?
Well, this has been debated for 70 years,
Steve.
The question of whether or not, for example, Auschwitz, which is near Krakow in southern Poland, should have been bombed or whether the rail approaches to Auschwitz should have been bombed, this has been hotly debated. My feeling is that particularly when it comes to physically liberating the camps that are in Germany, we pedaled as fast as we could pedal. There's not any realistic way that you could have gotten there quicker. The question of bombing the camps, first of all, presumes that bombing is more of a precision weapon than it actually is. You would have killed a lot of prisoners. Trying to take out the rail lines that are bringing inmates to the death camps probably is a palliative that isn't going to be very successful for very long. It's hard to imagine that there were substantial, realistic things that could have been done that would have ameliorated the German determination to kill as many millions of people as they could.
Again, Rick Atkinson is our guest. His new book, The Guns at Last Light, he speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For tickets, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. Richard from Overland Park, good morning.
Yeah, hi, guys. Great conversation.
Thanks.
Allow me to be brief so others can get in. Mr. Atkinson, I know at the end of World War II, the Japanese had some stragglers and people that held out and tried to continue to fight the war even though Japan had surrendered. Was there much of that or any of that in Germany?
Thank you, Richard. There was great anxiety by Eisenhower and others that the Germans were going to form what was known as the National Redoubt and that they were going to fight to the bitter end with tens of thousands of SS soldiers in the Alps, in Alpine hideouts. This proved to be kind of a fantasy. The Germans didn't have the wherewithal to do it. Hitler wasn't interested in doing it until really the very end of the war. April 1945 is when he first began thinking in these terms, and by then it was too late. So you did have a lot of diehards individually in certain towns like Heilbronn in western Germany, where they fought essentially to the bitter end, and sometimes women and children would stand on the roofs and throw bricks at American tanks rolling through. But you did not have the kind of hiding in the jungles for 20 years that you found in the case of some remote Pacific islands where Japanese soldiers held on forever.
Richard, thank you for the call.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen.
Let's go to Michael from Lawrence. Michael, you're on Up to Date with Rick Atkinson. Good morning.
Yes, my last name is Perlman. I aspire to be a military historian like Mr. Atkinson and a tennis player like Roger Federer. Anyway, I have a bit of a technical issue on, if I am correct, the United States Army had two opportunities to fight what may be called a decisive battle, to surround the German army and destroy it. Instead, we chose to attrit it. We gave it a lot of damage, but they were able to come back. In fact, the people who came back from the Falaise Pocket in August 1944 conducted the Bulge in December 1944.
Right.
Is this, what does Mr. Atkinson attribute this? Are we not gamblers? You can get big payoffs if you take big risks.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Rick?
Thanks for the question, Michael. From Lawrence, Kansas, which is my wife's hometown. Well, you know, there were many gambles taken during the war by the Western Allies. The gamble to invade North Africa in November 1942 is one of the most extraordinary risks taken by any army ever. It's a time when the German submarine threat is at its highest. So I
that was the subject of your first book.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So there are risks taken. The gamble to go into Normandy in the teeth of defenses that have been prepared by Erwin Rommel, that's an enormous gamble. There is a kind of passivity, you might say, when it comes to trying to conduct a war or a battle of obliteration at places like the Falaise Pocket, where the Germans have been routed from Normandy. Beginning in late July of 1944, we've got them on the run. We've got them channeled through the valley in Falaise, which is west of Paris. And we don't finish the job. And we kill tens of thousands of them, but we don't get as many as we could have and probably should have. And you're right. There are a lot of commanders, particularly, who get away, and they form the nucleus of the defenses that subsequently stop us at the German border and then provide the forces that counterattack during the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944. So, again, people have been talking about this for 70 years. There have been lots of criticism of the way that that Eisenhower and Montgomery and Omar Bradley orchestrated those battles. I think you need to walk a mile in their shoes to really understand. I'm very critical of those men and others, the senior commanders, in those circumstances and in other circumstances. And yet I understand how things like that happen. Having watched the Latter-day Army, for example, I was with the 101st Airborne Division going to Baghdad. Was that a perfect operation? Not really. Hmm. And that's part of the nature of war. Things don't go as they should go, and they almost never go as they should go in retrospect.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with Rick Atkinson and his new book, The Guns at Last Light, and we'll go into the auditorium at St. Paul's School in West London, where leaders met to plan the invasion of Europe and D-Day, when we come back. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's discussions about the Missouri legislative session and fantasy art, you can find those and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Well, Jim Gaffigan knows that a four-year-old eating a taco and throwing a taco on the floor is pretty much the same thing. Tomorrow on the program, the comedian joins us right here in our studios. This hour, visiting with Rick Atkinson, his new book, The Guns at Last Light. It's the final book of his trilogy of books on World War II. Again, he speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Tickets, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. And you can join our conversation here in our studios as well by calling 816-235-2888. You can email us at uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Well, Rick, The Guns at Last Light begins with the planning for the invasion of Europe. Take us inside the auditorium at St. Paul's School in West London, where leaders were meeting to plan the invasion. You call this the Great Anglo-American Military Conclave of World War II, meeting on the 1,720th day of the war to rehearse what they were calling the death blow. Who was there? What was the atmosphere like that day?
Yeah, it's a great scene.
It's a great scene. Yeah, absolutely.
It's May 15th, 1944, and St. Paul's School is one of those tabernacles of upper-class England. The poet John Milton, among many other luminaries, went there. And you have Eisenhower, Omar Bradley, George Patton, Bernard Montgomery.
Patton, who arrives a little late.
Patton is late, bangs on the door to be let in, irritating everyone. King George VI is there. Churchill is there. And there are several dozen of the most senior commanders who are going to oversee Overlord, which is the invasion of Normandy, to take place 3 weeks later. And they're going to go over, rehearse essentially the plan one last time. And in this auditorium, it was known as the Model Room, on the floor there was an enormous plaster of Paris relief map.
Of the coastline, right?
6 inches to the mile of this part of France where the River Seine spills into the Atlantic. And there was a British brigadier with no skid socks shuffling across this map with a pointer as they would discuss, for example, the beaches, Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, Sword, and the towns that would soon become famous on what would become in 3 weeks the most famous battlefield in the world, towns like Saint-Lô and Cannes and Cherbourg. And so they spent the day. It was a full day's conference to go over the plan. All of the senior commanders stood up and talked about their role in the air support or the naval gunfire aspects of it. And at the end, they basically resolved, okay, we're going to do this. The date at that point was set for June 5th, 1944. It would be delayed a day because of bad weather. And the plan that they laid out in the model room at St. Paul's School was largely the plan, with some wrinkles and some aggravations that hadn't been anticipated, but it was largely the plan that they had examined on May 15th.
You know, the conclave breaks up, and Eisenhower, I think it was, said to someone, well, the Germans just missed their chance to take out the entire high command of all the Allied forces here. What a missed opportunity.
Well, a single bomb on St. Paul's School would have – now, it's improbable. The Germans didn't have the capacity at that point, and there was, needless to say, a lot of air cover protection and so on. This is all highly secret, as you might well imagine. All of the planning for Normandy was extraordinarily secret because there was a recognition that if the Germans had even a day or 2 days' notice that this great armada was coming, along with the great armada of airplanes, bringing men by parachute and by glider, that it could be disastrous. It was hard enough as it was.
But certainly the Germans must have known if the Americans are going to come, they're going to come somewhere along this coastline, which is so close to the coastline of southern England, obviously. Why weren't they even better prepared than they were? They were prepared, but why weren't they even better prepared?
Well, they have a 3,000-mile coastline to defend from Norway to the Spanish border, for one thing.
They're overextended in a sense.
Well, they are. They don't have enough, and they're having all kinds of problems fighting the Russians. Let's not forget the Russians are doing most of the bleeding and the dying. But if you assume that they're going to land in France somewhere, there was an enormous deception operation. It was known as Fortitude, and it was run by the British, who had a genius for guile and deception. And the presumption was by many in the German high command that the landings would come at the Pas de Calais, which is actually the nearest point of France to England, and farther north than Normandy. And there were many wrinkles within the deception plan to convince the Germans that the landings would come elsewhere, that in fact the landings that did occur on June 6, 1944 were just a deception, that there was a bigger army led by George Patton waiting to come at the Pas de Calais. The Germans took this hook, line, and sinker, and they were aware that there were going to be landings coming probably sometime in the summer. They didn't know precisely when. They didn't know where. And consequently, when five divisions fall on those beaches at Normandy, they're taken aback, and they don't respond quickly enough to throw these forces back into the sea.
You know, it's absolutely fascinating to me that in the preparation for D-Day, the Allies, the British particularly, go so far as to – they had covert operations to scout out different locations, testing what the solidity of the sand on the beaches. Things went that far, that much detail to figure the whole thing out.
Yeah, there were commando units that were discharged from submarines, and they would swim ashore onto the beaches at Normandy at night and bring back samples of the sand to determine whether it was, in the military term, trafficable, whether or not tanks and trucks could roll across these beaches. The Germans had a number of agents in England, and the Brits captured all of them and turned all of them. Every one of them was captured, interrogated, and turned without the Germans knowing it. Turned meaning there would be false messages and false information that was radioed back to the agents' handlers, most of them operating in Lisbon at the time, again feeding this big deception operation. It was quite brilliant.
At one point, you found out in your research that there was some talk and some plan about actually, instead of going across the sea and going across by air, to go at least in part by digging a tunnel underneath the English Channel and coming up that way. What happened to that idea?
Well, if you know that it's going to be hazardous to go across the sea and land on those beaches.
And it's very treacherous to go across that sea.
The English Channel itself is treacherous. The Germans are waiting for you on the beaches. You know that going by parachute or glider is very treacherous. There was a discussion and a study done on digging a tunnel, what we would call the channel today, under the English Channel. And the study report came back, said, yes, we can do this. It'll take 15,000 miners a year to excavate 50,000 tons of spoil. But we can do this. What they couldn't finesse, what they could never figure out, was what happens when that first miner pops his head out of the tunnel in Normandy and the entire German 7th Army is waiting for him. So that went back. They went back to the drawing board and took a more conventional approach.
But still, even in the planning of all this, the Allies had a pretty good sense, and you write about all this in the book, about exactly what kinds of what numbers of casualties would be inflicted in the course of the D-Day operations. They had a pretty good sense of exactly what they were getting into and what the price was going to be, what price would be paid for it.
Yeah, and in fact, there was great anxiety that the casualties would be higher than they actually were. Omaha Beach was tougher than they expected. The Germans had moved some reinforcements in there that we were not aware of. There were tables and things called Evitt's rates in which you calculate what you think the resistance is going to be like versus the number of men you're throwing into that resistance, and therefore you can calculate how many pints of blood and how much plasma you need and all of that. There were some who believed that the airborne troops in particular, the 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne for the Americans, and the British 6th Airborne Division, were going to be slaughtered. And right really up until the time that the invasion was launched, there were those who were urging Eisenhower to reconsider this because there was concern that they would be so vulnerable as they came sifting in by parachute or arriving by glider.
Now, you do wonder, in the course of reading this book, about the pressure on one man, and that man being Dwight Eisenhower. You describe him in considerable detail throughout this book, Rick, and you talk at one point about sort of his physical bearing, showing the stresses of all of this, and the fact that at one point in the war he was going through 40 Camel cigarettes a day. That's a lot of Camels.
Yeah, well, it's actually more than that. At one point, he's smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day. It's 80 cigarettes. He's never without a cigarette in his hand. His blood pressure is awful.
So much so that he doesn't allow his doctors to test him any longer for fear they'd send him home or something.
That's right. He's concerned that somebody's going to blow the whistle on him and that he'll be medically evacuated. Yeah, I've lived with him now for 14 years through the 3 books of this trilogy, and my admiration for him has only grown.
He's I was going to ask.
Yeah, well, he's not a particularly good field marshal. He's not a great captain, as they say in the military. He doesn't see the battlefield temporally and spatially like a Napoleon would, but that's not really his job. He defines himself as chairman of the board. That's the phrase he uses, and it's chairman of the largest martial enterprise on Earth, a very fractious alliance, and his job is to hold it together and to wield it as a terrible swift sword. he's quite brilliant at that. He's got a gift for getting along with allies. He's got a natural political ability. It's the reason that Roosevelt chose him. Roosevelt, the master politician, recognizes that same trait in Eisenhower. I think what we see is a man who is not a traditional Ulysses Grant on the battlefield, but he is the man for the job, for that job and that enormous job and the job with all the pressures. He's very aware that every time he issues an order, thousands of lives are at stake, and that he is ordering young men to their deaths. And that's a difficult thing for anyone to bear.
He's 52, 53 years old in the course of this book. Not an old man by any stretch.
That's
right. The prime
right.
of his career.
Yeah, he's West Point class of 1915. And, of course, he's from Abilene, Kansas. And one of the interesting things about him, at a time when Anglophobia is rampant in the American general officer ranks, almost all the generals just detest the British. Eisenhower, this guy who grew up in small town Kansas, likes the British. He's got a worldview that's pretty expansive, and they reciprocate. They like him personally. This is one of the keys to his success. Is that he's got the ability to turn the other cheek in the face of insolence or impertinence from the likes of General Montgomery, who can be really insufferable, and he's got the ability to get along and get people to do what he wants them to do, and that's part of the art of command and the art of leadership.
Rick Atkinson is our guest. His new book, The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe, 1944 to 1945. You want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up-to-date at kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR up-to-date. Cheryl writes us on Facebook, and Rick, you're going to love this question because of your own feelings about this man. Could Rick Atkinson please comment on the heroism of one Theodore Roosevelt Jr. at D-Day, one of your favorites out of this book?
He is one of my favorites. He's been one of my favorites for all three books because we start with him during the invasion of North Africa in 1942, and then we have him in Sicily for volume two of my book.
Yeah.
He's a fascinating character, partly because he's the son of the 26th president, and he spends most of his life trying to live up to a father whose face is carved on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, right.
And yet he's very accomplished in his own right. He's a war hero in World War I. Between the wars, he helps he's the chairman of American Express. He's the governor general of the Philippines and Puerto Rico. He's an author. He's an explorer. He helps found the American Legion, and then he comes back into uniform for World War II, and we see him in these earlier battlefields. He is the senior officer in the first wave at Utah Beach on June 6, 1944, and he recognizes that the landing is going awry, that in fact currents and navigation errors have pushed them more than a mile off course, and he doesn't panic. He says, okay, basically we'll start the war from here. It turns out to be fine. Utah Beach is much easier compared to Omaha, for example. A month later, he's still in Normandy because American and British troops are somewhat bottled up, and his son, Quentin, who's an officer in another division, comes over to spend the evening with him, and they spend several hours chatting about the family and the war and what they'll do after the war. Quentin leaves. Roosevelt has a massive heart attack and dies. I hate to say goodbye to him. He never knows when he dies in July 1944 that first he's about to get his own division. Eisenhower signed the order earlier that day giving him the 90th Division, and he never knows that he's going to be awarded the Medal of Honor for his heroics at Utah Beach. So he
deserved perhaps at least that much, it sounds like.
Well, he's just a marvel. He's a great writer. So his letters home to his wife, improbably named Eleanor Roosevelt, are fantastic. and for a writer like me, he's just somebody that is really great to have in your cast of characters.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some calls. Tom from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'd like to ask your question, your guest, Steve, a question.
Yes, go ahead, Tom.
And that is, over the years, what sort of portrait, as far as accuracy and general flavor, has Hollywood given us in viewing the Normandy invasion?
Well, thanks, Tom. That's a good question, and there have been books written about that, too. You know, I think if you've seen Saving Private Ryan, that first 22 minutes of that, Steven Spielberg, the cinematographer is Janusz Kominski, I think that gives you a pretty good idea of what the invasion was like on Omaha Beach.
I can still hear those bullets sitting in the movie theater. That was my first time I think I really got a sense of this is what a bullet right. sounds like, and you get a sense of probably what it would feel like.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary depiction. After that, my opinion is, although I like the movie, it becomes kind of a buddy movie, and it's rather ordinary. But I think that first 22 minutes or so is one of the great pieces of filmmaking ever. Otherwise, I think you're kind of hard-pressed to find depictions of the war that really bear up and that really give you either a sense of the personalities. Now, I think the movie Patton with George C. Scott in the title role is brilliant. And
that was a number of years ago that thing came out.
I think it was 1970. And that really gives you a sense of Patton. Everything but the voice. Patton actually had a high, squeaky voice.
Is that right?
Yes. It's very dissonant from this large, imposing, physically overbearing man when you hear Patton's actual voice. And George C. Scott, of course, has a voice that would seem to fit the persona better. You know, you're hard-pressed otherwise to find movies that really take the story and go beyond the magnificence of it.
Joe, we're kind of answering your question. Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, go ahead.
Yes, I remember that movie, The Longest Day, with so many great stars, and that's kind of how I, think of V-Day. Is that a good story for D-Day?
Well, that is based on a book by Cornelius Ryan, who was an Irish journalist who traveled with American troops in World War II and then emigrated to the United States. He wrote three terrific books. The Longest Day was the first of them, A Bridge Too Far, and The Last Battle, and then he died prematurely in 1974. The books, in my estimation, are better than the movies, and he gets better and better as he goes along. A Bridge Too Far is really a masterpiece. Henry Fonda plays, we were just talking about Ted Roosevelt Jr., Henry Fonda plays him in The Longest Day. It's kind of an ensemble movie. It's fun to watch, and it's a bit of a period piece in the sense that we're still thinking all the brothers are valiant and all the sisters are virtuous in that kind of depiction of what happened then. The killing of prisoners, the mishaps and mistakes and screw-ups that happen in war and certainly happened in Normandy are not depicted in any detail. So I haven't seen it in a long time, but my guess is that the movie doesn't hold up particularly well.
Who's going to make a movie of The Guns at Last Light?
I don't know, but I'd be happy to talk to somebody about it.
But you would.
It'd be a big budget production, wouldn't it?
I'm just wondering about some of the scenes of this book, St. Paul's School, for instance, other famous battlefields. How much of that is still there? Can you walk into St. Paul's School and walk into that auditorium today? Or what's there?
Sadly, nothing's there. St. Paul's moved across the Thames. Mm. St. Paul's is still around as it has been for, eons. There's a plaque that was recently dedicated where St. Paul's had been on Hammersmith Road. So that is not there.
Wow.
There are photos, though, that in fact the librarian at St. Paul's, I corresponded with him and he sent me stuff about the school from the 1940s. All the kids had been evacuated and were off in a safer place in the countryside going to school. There are many other things, though, to see. In Northern Europe, battlefields tend to be well-preserved. The French are grateful to what we did. The American Battle Monuments Commission cemeteries, there are about two dozen of them around the world. They're spectacular. They're powerfully moving. The one in Carthage in Tunisia is unbelievable. The one above Omaha Beach, of course, is famous. And there's a lot of signage at places like the Normandy and the Battle of the Bulge. And with a little effort, you can go to some of the lesser-known places, Mortain, for example, which is on the edge of Normandy, and Hill 314, where the 30th Division held out for a long time against a ferocious German counterattack.
Can you see the battles when you're there? Can you picture them in your mind, Rick, as you get there?
I certainly can, and of course I spend a lot of time preparing. I take maps and accounts and so on. But yeah, I think you can see how things unspooled for the most part. You can go to the area in the Ardennes in Belgium and Luxembourg and get some sense of what happened there in the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah. We have a Tom writes us at UpToDate at KCUR.org. Congratulations on completing the trilogy. What's next?
Oh, thanks, Tom. Well, I'm thinking about it, to be honest with you.
You want to move away from World War II, from what I read.
I am, yeah.
Imagine that.
14 years is enough. I decided some time ago not to do the Pacific, in part because it would require me to move back in time. I'd have to go back to Pearl Harbor 1941 or earlier, and I don't want to do that. So I'll find something with American military history, some war someplace, and I'm pondering it right now.
I'm wondering, at the end of the day, we just have about 40 seconds left, Rick, how much of an accomplishment was it for the West to defeat Nazi Germany? Was it inevitable, or was it a whole lot more than that?
It's a whole lot more than that because, again, let's not forget the Russians. The Russians do most of the fighting. They do most of the bleeding. They do most of the dying. They do most of the killing. 90% or more of German dead are dead because of the Russians. The Russians lost 26 million of their own dead.
26 million.
So there's nothing inevitable about any of it, and we certainly did our part. But it's very important to remember that the Soviet Union was the arch nemesis of Hitler in this war.
It's been a pleasure to have you. Congratulations on getting this thing done. Just what a magnificent accomplishment it is, Rick. My hat's off to you. Congratulations again.
Thanks, Steve. It's always a delight to be with you.
You bet. Rick Atkinson is the author of The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe, 1944 to 1945. He speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You can find more information on all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Well, Jim Gaffigan knows that a four-year-old eating a taco and throwing a taco on the floor is pretty much the same thing. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with a comedian about his new book, Dad is Fat. The show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you today.